So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety.
Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast, coming to you live and in color from from Middle Tennessee. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
And David, is it my imagination or are you losing weight, man?
Oh, you're so sweet. Yes, I am. Damn it.
Okay.
And no, I'm in such a great mood about it. That's it. Yes, thank you. I'm trying. Uh-huh. I'm trying to behave myself, but what I'm really trying to do is take care of myself.
That's good.
Trying to take a different approach this time.
Self-care, man. It's amazing to me how during my years of active addiction, I think mentally, I don't know that I would ever say it out loud, but I really felt that by rewarding myself with that destructive behavior, I was in some way caring for myself.
Yeah, it's like all the other, you know, behaviors that we push against. I think it, you know, it's this love-hate thing. Mm-hmm. I will show you, I will eat a bowl of ice cream. You know, but the same cycle, you know, I was finding with food that if I get into a negative space, that's a safe go-to. You know, I will reward myself with something and then regret it.
This I've been reading lately a lot about shame. I'm on to Kurt Thompson's book, The Soul of Shame, by the way, fantastic book, breaks down the mechanics of shame much more clearly than I've ever heard before. Not to say that somebody else hasn't done equally well, but I'm finally awake and listening, right?
Yeah.
And I remember trying to shame my way out of my compulsive sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Unaware that I was thinking I'm applying the brakes, I'm really hitting the gas, that shame is actually driving the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm medicating shame with a shameful behavior, then trying to shame my way out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is there a tie-in there? People sometimes ask me, you know, what behavioral addiction is similar to sex addiction?
Mm-hmm.
And the one to me, that strikes most closely, the program that is most helpful, that's not a sex addiction program, most helpful to guys in my situation, in my opinion, is OA.
Yeah.
It's overeaters. There's something about, I don't know what it is about that food thing. What do you think? Is there a shame tie-in? I know that there is a lot of talk these days about body shaming, right? I feel terrible because I feel fat.
Yeah.
Okay. And yet, somehow, that shame is not strong enough for me to adopt a new eating routine.
Yeah. You know, if shame were a great motivator, I guess, you know, we'd all be calendar ready or something.
Yeah, right,
models.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that, you know, your brain doesn't know. From the study that the work that I did towards certification, they were always telling us that the brain doesn't know the difference between, you know, a shot of whiskey, an orgasm, and a chocolate cake.
Okay.
You know, you get the same chemical payoff.
Okay.
Now, consequences may differ and your spouse may have opinions about one over another, depending on where you're getting your orgasm.
That's right.
But honestly, your brain is going to places, is going to take you places in that reward system mm-hmm. with any of these behaviors. But yet the shame that follows is very much the same because, even with food, and food is such an accepted
Yes.
You can have highly moralistic people in points of view.
Right.
But man, you bring them a hash brown casserole and they'll do in a pan of it and then they'll, joke that it was just a bad day or whatever.
Right,
and I've been there too. And interestingly, too, we're seeing body dysmorphia issues and anorexia equally now among adolescent males
yes.
as we are females.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. That some people are saying, well, it's because now males in our culture are freer to talk about it.
Yeah.
But it's also that with pornography and a lot of male body image
yes.
that guys are exposed to, I mean, walk down the, not throwing rocks at Men's Fitness, but let's face it, enough of those magazines in Kroger while you're picking up groceries and you're going to feel like, I'm going to wear a sheet and not leave the house.
Because
I can't be that.
Yeah.
And a makeup artist friend of mine said that she was on a photo shoot one day and she said, well, we shade those abs with makeup.
Yeah.
Dark to light, dark to light, spray, And so even the guys that look like that don't look like that.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other thing.
Holy smokes.
But never mind all of that. It still plays into our relationship with ourselves and our expectations and our relationship to behavior and what we medicate.
Well, we are going to carry on in kind of a different vein this week. We've got a guest. We're going in a direction we haven't ever gone before.
Right.
I have a little bit of anxiety about it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, some excitement, too, because I think maybe we're going to have a conversation that's long overdue. So stay with us. We'll be back in a moment on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and Nate and I have a special guest today. Nate, we are normally talking about substances, behaviors, substance use disorder, all kinds of things with regard to families and spouses and relationships where addictive behavior is concerned. And today we're taking a little bit of a different turn. In our approach with our guest.
Or perhaps to a substance that's not ordinarily understood to be addictive.
Right. And that may actually show up in the way we use other substances or are influenced to crave other substances. Our guest is Michael Collins, and Michael has made a career and a life of exposing the evils of sugar that we all kind of knew existed anyway. And Michael, I'll tell you what, right now, this is very timely because I have gone on a 4-week now, no candy, no desserts, no ice cream, no sweets, no sugar stuff. Now, I know that I probably ended up with sugar in my, organic fig spread.
I guarantee it.
So I know that I'm not like in perfect compliance. But I will tell you that I had very similar responses in giving this behavior up as I did when I quit drinking in 2005. I'll tell you a quick story. I had a friend in my house, this is about 4 weeks ago, and I had some homemade cookies that somebody had given me. There were like 4 left. And I told him I was going on this thing. I was going to give up sugar, give up sweets. I'm going to get my weight back under control and going back to the gym, doing all the right things.
And he goes, what are you going to do with these 4 homemade cookies? And I said, well, you know, I'll just leave them here and I'll take them to work or give them to somebody. And so he grabs this little Ziploc bag of the 4 cookies. He crushes them up, pounds them on my kitchen island down to powder. Okay. So they're crushed up down to powder and he throws them in the trash. He throws them in my kitchen waste can and he goes, okay, so that's solved. And he leaves. And about, so about 7 o'clock that night, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I could pour those into a bowl with milk and eat them like cereal. So this is so reminiscent of when I would throw away booze but not pour it out. And I didn't do it. I will go on the record and say before, you know, God and these witnesses, I did not do it. But it was I had this compulsive thought and I was in this terrible mood for about 3 days. And so anyway, talk to me about what is similar and why is my body reacting that way and my brain reacting that way? Because this is a legal substance and this is not supposedly horrible. And yet here I am thinking about digging it out of the trash can. How's that for a lead-in?
you're not alone. I'll put it to you that way. If you spend 5 minutes in my inbox or my Facebook Messenger, you know that there's a lot of people that have those same thoughts and feelings all day, every day. You know, I do want to correct one thing that you guys talked about. This, in my view, is a substance use disorder. As chairman of the Food Addiction Institute, which is a nonprofit that's been around since 2005, that's our stated goal to get it named as substance use disorder in the DMS-6 when it comes out. And so you guys know Rodney Dangerfield, right? Mm-hmm. Rodney has got a tagline, I get no respect, right? Yeah. Sugar gets no respect as a drug of addiction, right? And, you know, guys, in the world of recovery, you know that there are 5 different food addiction 12-step programs, right?
Right.
And anecdotally, if you will, and experientially more, in the last 40 years, we have proven that people who adhere, who believe that they have a biochemical reaction to sugar and flour in their bodies, we've proven that people who adhere to an abstinence-based recovery in the food world, in the flour and sugar world, fall to a right-sized body and recover from a lot of symptoms that you and I would all call substance use disorder. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't start this thing as a health nut or anything. I'm a recovering addict. I've been sober 34 years and, you know, and only in the last 5 years has the brain science, the dopamine, the serotonin, all this stuff, has that caught up with the anecdotal and experiential evidence that's happened in 40 years in the church basements of 12-step food recovery. Mm-hmm. So locked in that anonymity is the solution to people. It's this, honestly, genuinely the solution to the $72 billion diet industry. That some folks, about a third, we predict, or we not predict, that we have kind of measured, if you will, or over time, biochemically cannot ingest sugar, right?
Wow.
And they end up having the same thing that happened to you, and they get diabetes, and they gain 100 or 200 or 300 pounds, they lose limbs, they go blind, and they still cannot quit sugar. Mm-hmm. If that's not the definition of an addiction or a substance use disorder, I'm not sure what is.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I don't want to get all serious on you, but I want to
fair. Yeah.
I want to start off on the right foot.
Right.
And, you know, I want you guys, I really appreciate you having me on. We'll start with that. We'll back up a little bit. You guys are very serious about your getting information about drug addiction and alcoholism out in the world. And I'd like to add to that a little bit, if you can.
Absolutely. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Tell us some more of your story, will you, Michael?
Yeah, sure.
You've been in recovery now for more than 30 years. How did this journey start for you? And what led you to this realization that sugar was a major problem?
Yeah, it's a great question. Now, I have what I call the podcast version. You guys can, it's short and you can, you know, mm-hmm. kind of jump in afterwards, but I was just a regular kid, you know. I mean, my mother was a sugar junkie, and it's an interesting story that her mother died when she was 8 years old, and they moved in with an aunt, and her father and the aunt gave her permission of the other uncle who worked across the street in the local country store and owned the store, that she could have any kind of candy she wanted because they felt so bad for her because she lost her mom. Mm. And that started the sugar addiction that lasted her whole life and I believe killed her. And so, fast forward, I'm a kid. I'm a regular kid. My mom's a sugar junkie. I know where her stash is. If I didn't put enough sugar on my Cheerios to get a quarter inch of sugar to scrape off, then I didn't put enough on there. And candy, you're not even recognition. We're about to, this was a common thing. And, we used to eat bread and butters and sugar sandwiches, right? We didn't have a lot of money. And that was one of the staples as kids that we could feed ourselves. And as much as, when we made the Kool-Aid, it was like, we had complete and utter, they didn't care how much sugar we put in. And it was not exactly by the recipe, I guarantee. And so beyond that, it was always sugar, 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 candy, 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 whatever. And I realized it changed my state. I didn't know then back then. There's a great quote. You guys can look this up on 60 Minutes. It's got Eric Clapton with Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes. They're sitting at a $7 million Antigua treatment center. And Ed goes to Eric Clapton. He says, Eric, this addiction thing, this all started with heroin, right? And Eric Clapton says, no, Ed, it started with sugar. And Ed's like quizzically says, sugar? And so Eric goes on to talk about bread and butter and sugar sandwiches. I'm like, oh, my goodness. And we used to eat those. And he says, it changed my state. Well, the same thing happened to me. And then when I about 13 or 14, beer came into the picture, right? Mm-hmm. And I realized that I could talk to girls, and it really changed my state, took that anxiety, that emptiness, that fear, that whatever I was attracted to, things that changed my state in me, it worked. And mm-hmm. went on. And the short version of that is went to college, drugs, alcohol, rock and roll, girls, the whole nine, till I was about 28 years old, and I got sober. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you as much about that story. I'm completely open about it. It doesn't matter. But, I want to kind of stick to the sugar theme a little bit, in that after I got sober, my wife was in recovery as well, and I read a book called Sugar Blues. And Sugar Blues was written by a guy named William Duffy. Duffy was at a party one time, and he heard a voice from behind say, he was putting two lumps of sugar in his coffee. And she said, I wouldn't have that in my house, let alone my body. And he recognized the voice. It was Gloria Swanson, the famous movie star, right?
Oh, wow. From classic movies.
All the classic movies, right? And so he ends up marrying Gloria Swanson and writing Sugar Blues in the late 70s, early 80s. And I read it in the early 80s. And it just somehow tripped my trigger. Here I am, 2 years or so sober, or whatever, just getting into recovery. And somehow I talked my ex-wife, my wife at the time, into having a childbirth with no flour, no sugar, no caffeine in the womb until I had those kids. We didn't have sugar. Those kids didn't have sugar till they were 6 years old. And the story continues. That's another long story about how we went through it, how it happened, and what happened afterwards. But I went on to have a regular business career. I stayed in sobriety. I mean, I was very active in 12-step programs and recovery and sponsorship and everything. But I had a regular business career, did okay in business. And about 9 or 10 years ago, I bought the domain sugaraddiction.com. And I started putting out products and stuff, but nobody seemed to get help and didn't seem to work too well. The information alone didn't work, right? Mm-hmm. So then I about 3 or 4 years ago, I said, what do I do the rest of my life? I'm getting near 60 years old. It's like, I did okay in business. And I started coaching people online and in person. And then started forming small groups, both online and in person. Mm-hmm. And that's how people started to get well. It wasn't adjunct, if you will, sometimes to the 12-step movements of Food X, Anonymous and Recovery, and different other ones. But that's the short podcast version. I'm willing to, you know, explain or talk about anything that I brought up in that little, you know, from 0 to 60 years old. But, you know, that's the short version.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that because this is really interesting to me, Michael, because when I first got sober, you know, I kept Bluebell ice cream in business. I mean, that was like, you know, that and I probably did a quick replacement of, you know, there's substances time. And, you know, cross addiction or whatever. But I wasn't getting pulled over, you know, for too much ice cream. That was the difference. But what I didn't understand at the time was that maybe sugar could have been, and I've looked at some of your material, and it sounds like you might believe that maybe sugar was even contributing to my depression and my anxiety and all those things that I thought was simply my alcohol withdrawal.
Right. No, I absolutely believe that. One of the things that has come to the fore in the last 5 years is the brain science around this and the dopamine receptors and the serotonin and the oxytocin and the GABA and even your adrenals are affected by this drug. And it's dose dependent. It's like, you know, you can ingest, you know, the statistics of how much we eat all day and every day in the United States. And so the idea that, you know, you hear these things that it's 8 times more addictive than cocaine in these crazy studies, but regardless of what there's no way to make that claim anyway. But what I'm getting at here is that when you study addiction, you understand that it's not really the substance that gets you, the alcohol or the heroin. What gets you is the effect that the substance has on your dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, GABA, oxytocin. Mm-hmm. It's the pounding that these brain reward chemicals get day in and day out by the drug or the sugar, and sugar is affecting this. This is no longer a mystery. This is a scientific fact, and it depends again on your dose, and you can vary your dose day in and day out, up and down. And the one thing people don't graph, chronicle, follow up, journal, they don't figure out, they don't follow, both in their children and in themselves, what happens when they ingest sugar and what happens when they crash. And what it's so ubiquitous and damn near free that they can just, since they're a child, they have reached for this product to quell anger, fear, hurt, resentment, pain, literally. So they don't tie the two together. They just think it's life. 300 years of enculturation back from the slave trade in England, when they had grew a monopoly and a drug cartel larger than El Chapo ever dreamed of, was that? We're talking about, like, this is a enculturated product that is people just don't see it as a substance used to something that could possibly be affecting exactly what you described, their brain. And their feelings and their depression and all these things. When in reality, when you talk with recovering people, which I've talked to thousands of people who have, you know, lost 100 pounds and gone years without sugar and flour, I'll tell you the fastest growing group of people in my coaching programs. Since I went public 2 years ago with my substance use disorder, it's people in recovery 5, 10, 15, 20 years. One of my coaches is 20 years in recovery. And it wasn't until we started working together that she finally, and she had been to 12-step food programs, that she started to realize that she had to treat like her addictions.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, I want this to be lighthearted a little bit. I don't want to be this guy, the candy anti-cake guy. I really don't. I mean, I'm not, it's like, do I want to, is this something I want to take on? Because this is a 30-year game. This changing society is going to take time.
Yeah.
And, but I can't do it to the kids anymore. I see now what's happening to, you know, a third of children being obese and overweight. It's crazy. And I know what's causing it. So anyway.
Yeah.
Now don't get me off my soapbox, guys. Talk
to me. No, you're here before your soapbox.
Well, I'll tell you where this subject intersects with my life, or actually, this is more a story about my wife, and I don't think she'll mind. We went to see a functional medicine physician a few weeks ago, Allie's seeking help for this chronic fatigue that just will not seem to go away, some other stuff. And so the doctor went through the medications that she's on. And then as an afterthought at the end, Allie says, oh, and you know, at bedtime, I found a magical way to go to sleep. I just, I can sleep if I eat two of these snack bars, and they're sold in the health aisle.
Yeah.
And the guy, so the doctor takes them and looks at him and goes, yeah, each one of these is, he said, 17 teaspoons of sugar in each bar. And we about fell over. Right. I wouldn't have known that there was anything. It's a health bar, for God's sake.
Sure.
Can you talk to us about how ubiquitous sugar is in the modern American diet, Western diet?
I'd love to. One of the things that I want to draw a separation that really I see, again, is kind of what my duty, if you will, is that sugar is made of 50% fructose and 50% glucose, right? It's a molecule that it's processed, right? It's a powder. And I draw the cocaine analogy only in that the Indians used to chew the leaves, and then we got the drug by reducing it to a white powder, cocaine.
Okay. Right?
And so fructose is half the molecule, right? And glucose is the other half. Now, the brain needs glucose to live, right? And it's, you know, you get it in vegetables and fruit and whatever. But here's the thing. Fructose is what they have discovered is the offending molecule. And fructose is, even in fruit, and this I get a lot of pushback on, the amount of fructose in a glass of orange juice is the same as it is in a Coca-Cola. And the body doesn't know the difference. And with the juice, it doesn't have the fruit to slow that slam to the liver, right? Mm-hmm. That's the only place that fructose is processed, right? Mm-hmm. And two of my mentors, who I've been following for a really long time, both MDs and both one a PhD, and they've been studying it in children and in adults for a long, long time, believe like I do that fructose is the psychoactive drug, okay? Glucose is going to get your body, but fructose is working on your mind, okay? And it's working on your reward centers. It's working on your dopamine and all the ones that I've mentioned before. And that's the issue. And high fructose corn syrup, you can see it graph. I don't know if I'm doing this right, but that if you look at when we were young, there was very few overweight or obese kids in our schools, right? In our classes. And you can look at the high fructose corn syrup that integrated into society and the food system in the 80s. And in the last 40 years, that's when the obesity numbers have gone crazy. And so you can look at it. It maps perfectly parallel, going straight up and to the right on a graph, the fructose entering the society and the food system all over the world, not just the United States, but all over the world, and the obesity numbers. They go straight up and to the right as well. And so fructose is the offending molecule. It's a psychoactive that is, I don't know how to really say this, but I really believe it's the perfect drug, okay? Mm-hmm. Meaning that it is so mellow, it is so well-being enhancing that when you try and quit, you feel like you can't quit. These are these symptoms that you try and it can work as a sleep aid, as you talked about with your wife, because you're basically taking the edge off of a day's worth of fructose, right? Mm-hmm. And knocking you out. And it will knock you out. It'll make, it'll put you to sleep after a while. But anyway, that's the scientific part of it. I don't have to really explain, I don't think, how much sugar has been integrated into our society. You know what I mean? It's insane, really. And it started with the high fructose corn syrup and has continued. So.
Okay.
Wow. And Michael, you said that we're starting to see a lot of kids with fatty liver disease.
Correct. Yeah. That's hurt.
Yeah. And that was typically, I mean, we all think of fatty liver as, you know, an alcoholic syndrome, right? I mean, as a physical manifestation of somebody that's abused alcohol or whatever. But correct. We're seeing kids with similar livers as alcoholic adults. Yeah. And you have studies that you point to that say, you know, this is all, you know, based on the fact that we are so dependent and just dishing up sugar by the cups full.
Right.
So when we go into places and, you know, your AA meetings are serving Krispy Kremes and your, you know, and I'll admit my office has a, you know, bowl of peanut M&Ms to soothe the, you know, poor, you know, week and a half sober guy that's got a lot of anxiety and jitters and all that stuff. You would say we're contributing to the problem.
I would. I you know, it's, again, I don't want to be this guy, but I can't ignore the science anymore, right? And I can't ignore the anecdotal history of 40 years of recovery in church basements that people who have adhered to abstinence from flour and sugar, they fall to a right-sized body, and they literally have to go through the same types of what I call emotional recovery. You guys are familiar. I mean,
you know
the construct or the concept that you stop maturing when you started using, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You stopped emotionally maturing.
Mm-hmm.
And I believed it. I mean, for many years, I knew it. You know, I started 14, 15 years old drinking beer. That's when I stopped. And I had to start again at 28 years old, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that the two are similar has been proven out over 40 years in these groups. And now they had to do the same. These are people who never touched alcohol, right? They never had alcohol, and they had to go through the same processes that you and I went through to get off of alcohol and drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And fatty liver is a physical symptom of the only place that fructose can be processed, and that's in the liver.
Okay.
It's not, you know, that's where it is processed. And the thing that makes fructose difficult, and why I get pushback on a lot of fruit, because fruit has been hybridized over 300 years into fructose bombs, basically. Let's look at a navel orange, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. There's no seed. How is this thing propagating in nature? How is this ever going to repeat itself without scientific intervention, right? So we get a beautiful navel orange, a very sweet navel orange, but it is primarily loaded up with fructose, right? There are no plants in nature that are poisonous that have fructose in them. We are attracted to fructose. We are attracted to this. And back in the day, you wouldn't recognize a banana. It was so full of seeds. And those little crab apples you see in the wild, that was what an apple looked like. That's how much sweetness it had. That's how much fructose it had in it. And over 300 years, it's been hybridized to be these beautiful packages of fructose. And again, we draw it back to the possibility, not the possibility, the proven scientific fact that fructose does hit these dopamine receptors, all your reward systems in the brain. Mm-hmm. And you've got a recipe for disaster. You know, and you've got high fructose corn syrup. You've got beautiful fruit. And so the society is ingesting fructose day in and day out. You know, it's a tough one. And the kids with the fatty liver are probably the reason I'm doing this, you know.
Yeah.
It's like there's no way to, and they're obese. I mean, you know how cruel children can be, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's hard, man. It hurts when they're saying fatty and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Right.
And
right.
And I don't know. It's I'm on the soapbox again, guys. No, come on, ladies. Right.
I hear you. You would rather be Willy Wonka, but you are a man on a mission. Tell us, where does flour fit into this? Because I've heard you say flour and sugar. I tend to put those in entirely different categories. What role does flour play?
It's a great question, and it's one that I get another bunch of pushback on. Is the again, I rely on the research, if you will, the R&D that done in the 12-step rooms for 40 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is that I think it's the wired together, fired together stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to work on it. I don't want to like claim this as something that's scientifically based yet, but I think the fructose bangs the mind and the glucose is banging the body. All right. Mm-hmm. And the two are together, married together. Bread reduces itself to sugar in your stomach right away. I mean, just mm-hmm. turns right into sugar. That can. Mm-hmm. And so process, you know, I had a couple people, and a lot of people are starting to say this, that I can't be calling this sugar addiction. This is processed food addiction, right?
Uh-huh.
And I think that the, you know, your insulin spikes with the flour and the heavy glucose, the processed, you know, mm-hmm. powdered stuff, right? It's a different thing than a vegetable glucose, you know, and I believe, I mean, it's like the cocaine leaf analogy, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think when it get reduced to a white powder through processing, it's a tough thing for the body to handle. I don't think the body can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, yeah, that's going to spike your insulin and, but it's also, like I said, it's the wired together, fired together. People don't seem to be able to separate the two. And most of the time, like 99% of the time, 98% of the people that ingest just flour, like just pasta and just bread a lot of bread has sugar in it anyway, so it has mm-hmm. fructose in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to put it, but people cannot, that have this biochemical predisposition, can't eat flour either. And again, mm-hmm. delivering more bad news, but that's the way.
Is there some correlation between people who are gluten intolerant and some of these things, or is that really another whole other disorder?
It is another thing, but I really believe that part. I'm a little radical, and I get a little crazy, but. You know, everything that's gluten-free has got sugar and flour in it, right? And it's like, right. Okay, it doesn't have gluten in it, but I somehow think the thing is all mixed together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you cannot, and I think that the gluten-free movement has accelerated or exacerbated the overweight thing, because it's like when they took fat out 30 years ago and they demonized fat, healthy fats. And you know that story, Gary Taubes' book, The Case Against Sugar, Why We mm-hmm. Get Fat, you know, very famous author, very Harvard researcher, very deep. Mm-hmm. He had to write a bunch of new books because the first one was 600 pages. And, you know, people wouldn't read it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all about that. You know, it's all about how that stuff evolved into the diet and that kind of thing. So.
Yeah. Well, let me take a different direction here for a minute, Michael. We are so medicated in our culture, probably some say the most medicated culture, America, or the West, whatever, but, with depression, mood disorders, things like that. How much evidence is there that sugar is playing a role in, chronic depression and anxiety disorders and things that, many of us, medicated with substances to try to, remedy?
Right. It's huge. I mean, the body of work that is left untilled or unearthed is huge. Mm-hmm. We recently did a Kick Sugar Summit, and you can look it up online. You can see the medical scientists from Harvard and Cornell and University of California. We've got 40 of them, okay? All scientists, all MDs, PhDs. Who have this evidence, it's there. One of the guys, Chris Palmer from Harvard, wrote an article about the summit about this exact topic that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it on, you can find the, in, it's in Psychology Today, he published it. And it was from the summit, and it was all of them having this research in varying degrees about sugar and depression, sugar and the mind, sugar and all kinds of psychoactive, or you know, anything that affects the mind. And it's the part that's ignored. It's you know, I have no issue, and I want to state this publicly, no issue with the sugar industries, just like you guys don't have any problems with the alcohol industry. It evolved over 300 years. Mm-hmm. They're there to, you know, create shareholder value. They have no idea, you know, but this is something that's different. You know, this is science that's coming out slowly, and it has been obfuscated a little bit by the sugar industry. Maybe the research has been... how shall I say it gently?
Well, you don't have to be gentle.
you have to check the source of the science. Put it that
right.
way.
Mm-hmm.
They have to do a disclosure. To get on our summit, they got to do a disclosure that they are not, they have never been funded by the food industry for their research. So anyway,
yeah,
it's out there. Put it that way. And I can send you whatever you need if you'd like.
The actual links.
I've got a question for you, a practical question, Michael.
Yeah.
This is the Positive Sobriety Podcast. We want to focus as much on what to do. Actually, more on put our focus on what to do instead of what not to do.
Yeah.
In my own mind, because sugar has been, since the time I was a child, used as a reward.
Mm.
You know, you're good, you get dessert. You're not good, you don't get dessert. Right? And I still need rewards these days. Yeah. There's a part of my brain that says that somehow if I were to walk away from processed foods, although I have done that to some degree already, but sugar specifically, if I'm going to go radical on this deal, that I'm leaving all the fun behind. There's no way to reward myself. And yet you look like a pretty happy and content guy. So when you're coaching people on making this transition, tell me, what's a practical way that I can reward myself if I want to change gears here?
It's a great question, and at the core of everything we do and everything recovery, okay? It is the hardest part of this is the societal nature of the reward system. And you guys, I'm sure, are familiar with the concept of self-care. And
right.
What we have to do is we have to create new self-care practices, a true practice, including a gratitude practice, but other self-care things, yoga, always think exercise. Doesn't have to be crazy, but that does help with the what's called when you use a lot of sugar and you're slamming your dopamine receptors, it's called what happens to them is called down regulation. They're down regulated. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You have less of them. So you have no way to feel better. Right. And so exercise, light exercise, just walking or yoga or swimming or something helps, or some kind of play, frisbee, whatever helps you upright. I don't think that's the right term, but helps bring back online your dopamine receptors, your feel goods, your serotonin, your oxytocin, these and good food and touch and massage and a beautiful sunset and saying I love you to somebody. These types of different social rewards are as valuable, probably more valuable, definitely more healthy than a manual manipulation of your feel goods, your reward centers in the brain by a substance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not telling you guys anything new that doesn't relate to what people call the hard drug substance use disorder world. And I don't like to make that delineation. I don't like to separate the two. I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to your question is you just Google self-care and you'll get different ones in 200, 300 different ways that we can care for ourselves that don't include reaching for a substance or rewarding children that don't require what you're describing. Mm-hmm. And it's this that has to change over. We're talking drinking and driving. We're talking condoms in bathrooms. We're talking smoking in public. These are things that society had to change and accept after the science proved that these things are probably killing us. And society, in our lifetime, all three of us have seen these changes in the societal norms of what is accepted as a reward system, or, you know, as those things. But in answer to your question, is there's a million different things that we can do to change, and we have to. This outing of, or this social change that has to happen in your family, in your workmates, because they're going to push you. They believe in this moderation thing, okay? Mm-hmm. They believe that, oh, you've been 3 months, you've lost 40 pounds, you look great, your skin is better, you seem to have more energy, you get to work earlier, you get up refreshed. Now you can have a little cake, right? That's like celebrating 3 months of sobriety with a beer, uh-huh. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I hope that helps.
No, that's great, because you know, one of the things that I've found since I've been exercising regularly again as part of the self-care, because I realized that there was a whole big part of me that was being neglected. When I get back from the gym, I'm not hungry.
Right.
You know, I mean, I would typically have thought that I was going to, you know, reward myself with some big amount of something because I thought I'd burned X calories, but I'm really not hungry. And the taste of food is changing to me. You know, there's something that you actually taste what food tastes like instead of, sure. You know, is this sweet enough?
Well, that, do you think that happens very rapidly, and people like it gets to the point where it's too sweet. You think that the stuff that you would normally like is too sweet. And, you know, you've heard of this chemical, it is chemical, but this food engineering stuff for the bliss point, right?
Mm-hmm.
The bliss point is that point where the right amount of sugar, the right amount of salt, the right amount of fat is perfect for the greatest majority of the bell curve of people.
Yeah.
And they literally test and engineer this into new products that have sugar and flour and caffeine and, you know, fat and salt and everything. And when we start to get healthy, when we start to stop using sugar, strange things taste sweet. Nuts taste sweet. I mean, it really is. And stuff that you would think like an ice cream or a whatever, it's just like too syrupy sweet. You know that taste, that too syrupy sweet. That's what happens to your taste buds.
So, So the same things that we would tell other people going through other types of recovery, that, you know, stimulate the prefrontal cortex with connection, creativity, doing things outside of ourselves, meditation, whatever that looks like for people. Those same things are what will help us engineer that shift if we are embarking on this type of thing. You know, that's going to help us take that shift away and that focus away from that deprivation mentality and
The recovery is identical. I mean, you guys know when a guy comes in or whatever, a person comes in for alcohol recovery, the only thing they want to learn how to do is to drink normally. That's the only goal.
Yeah. It's
just show me how to have two beers and leave it alone, you know?
Uh-huh.
And that's a slow process to get them over that hump, right?
Yeah.
So the same thing is here, you know, that this recovery is identical both in the emotional recovery and the abstinence part. And you have to ease folks into it. They are not ready to hear it about this. And anyone who is ready to hear it is truly a pioneer. Like the early folks of the, in Akron, they were the early folks, you know, those folks that the rest of society didn't want to hear it, you know?
Right.
And it took many, many years. So, so it's the same. It's identical.
Yeah.
You know, you go through the same processes socially, internally, physically, yourself, and emotionally yourself.
Yeah. Well, Michael, how can we get a hold of you? How can our listeners get in touch with you and follow what you're doing and your work and find some tools that will challenge them in their behavior with this whole relationship to sugar?
I got a book on Amazon. It's free to download, Last Resort Sugar Detox. You know, the kind of last house on the block thing there that people have tried all the other detoxes. And sugaraddiction.com. I mean, it's the home. That's where everything's based. We have a Facebook page. It's pretty large. People that follow. So, and a Facebook group. So we got, if you go to sugaraddiction.com, it'll lead you all that kind of stuff. And you can check it out. And lots of free stuff. There's quizzes and things you can take. You know, I don't know if you guys, I know when I took that first alcohol quiz, like, are you an alcoholic? Like 20 out of 20 or something. And, you know, we got one of those, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah, we got it.
Well, Michael, we just can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. This has been a very enlightening, and I keep telling myself this is a very, very, very good thing.
But it's hard to process, right?
It is.
It's hard, right? I mean, even guys like you, guys, a lot of recovery in the business. I mean, I have these discussions day in and day out. It's hard to get your mind around at the beginning.
Yeah.
Then you start to think about, and I just implore you to ask some of your friends that are in the food recovery groups.
Yeah. All right. Well, listeners, stay with us. We'll be back in a moment here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And Nate, I don't know if I feel like I've just been to confession or, if I finally just, you know, exposed the last deep, dark secret. Not that that's the last of all the deep, dark secrets, but, you know, this relationship to sugar is really, I know for a lot of people it's controversial, but for a lot of people it's really problematic. And I think people don't know how to address it and approach it, and the tie-ins that our guests made today, that Michael made with all the studies and research that is going into everything from mood disorders to connections to
but I can tell you what, I can already predict what my brain is going to tell me on the way because, you know, I'm considering taking a radical approach here, right?
Yeah.
And cutting out the sugar. And I know what my brain's going to say. One last binge.
Krispy Kreme. Drive through.
It's like the big toot before you go to treatment, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So look out, man. I see there's a well, anyway.
Yeah, I have a friend that drank on the plane all the way to rehab. And it was just the same thing. You
sure,
know?
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, because what am I going to? But you know, this is really I appreciate Michael's just his studied approach to this, because it's a tough thing to be the voice in the wilderness for something that is, you know, at the root of.
And he's a great guy, isn't he?
He's
a very engaging guy.
Yeah, he is.
Just straight ahead.
I expected somebody that was in a really bad mood.
And he doesn't look skeletal either.
No.
He looks,
actually
he looks healthy.
Healthy looking. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to have to check out sugaraddiction.com.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. I will if you will.
I will, yeah, because, I mean, I'm, you know, so far, I mean, God help me, I haven't had a piece of candy in 4 weeks, so I'm hanging. I'm trying. Okay. I did have my fig spread, I gotta say.
But. All right. Well, we have more great shows coming up. We got a nice roster of guests off in our future. So I guess until next time, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
We're your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.